meetings were held in a room on Franklin Avenue near Leffingwell. The sessions were long, from 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. with two short intermissions for lunch. And that's from the 25th Silver Anniversary Electrical Worker, and that was written by J.T. Kelly, then the press secretary for IBW Local 1 in St. Louis. And we return to that very special place, that small room on Franklin near Leffingwell, on our 127th anniversary of the founding of the IBW in this very room. And we come back here today. Today we introduce historian and author from St. Louis, Nene Harris. Nene, thanks so much for agreeing to sit down and talk to us about this wonderful building, the history behind it, and your active role in the renovation process. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be here, and I find any excuse I can to be in this building because it's half museum, half shrine, and to something that is so important in the history of the United States.
Before we talk about all this wonderful history, and I've learned, by the way, Nene and I go back a few years now, and I've learned a great deal from her. But before we get into the meat of this, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I had the good fortune to grow up in the neighborhood I live in South St. Louis City, in an old neighborhood with all these two-family flats. And the grandparents lived on the second floor, and the families with the children lived on the first floor. And you could go up and down the street and hear the stories of all these grandparents. And their stories brought alive how tough the Depression was, and much earlier. I'm a baby boomer, raised in the 50s, so the old folks were telling us about World War I and the tough times then, and they gave us a perspective on life that we were just so fortunate to have, because much of my peer group was raised in suburbs in nuclear families, and they didn't have all these stories and this history that we realized history is. It's not something off in a book. It's our story. It's what makes our lives what they are today.
And you attended St. Louis University?
Graduate. Yes. I went to junior college and took the bus there and then took the bus up to St. Louis U.
Specialized in history.
History.
Which we're going to talk about today.
It was founded in 1818. So we're having our 250th anniversary. And the Jesuits from Belgium took over the management of the then college in 1828.
How did you first come to be involved with the Henry Miller Museum project?
Well, I was talking about the rich history of downtown St. Louis, and this museum is just beyond the fringe of downtown St. Louis. And the architect, Jamie Henderson, who did such a wonderful job on working with you to restore this building, he heard me talking about that history and contacted me for input about this building.
And I know you contributed to Jamie's development of the original renovation plans. There were several architectural elements that you made sure that we got correct on the building. And early on in the project, you took me on a nice little tour of South City. You do these tours. They're called walks and talks, correct?
Yes.
Do you remember in particular about this building, the Henry Miller Museum, what architectural elements did you tell Jamie, okay, here's what you have to get right?
Well, we went to look at some buildings on Cherokee Street.
And Jamie went.
And I showed him buildings the same vintage, what the facades were like originally, how then they were altered. There were buildings like this one from mid-19th century with that same grainy brick. That grainy brick on the facade is very important because that's handmade brick. It's before you get the steam power that mixes a finer clay, and then the brick is a different color later on. So you maintain this brick facade. The other thing is that when this building was constructed, They didn't have these big storefronts that you have on the building currently, the big cast iron storefront. What they did with these buildings was they altered them and made technological changes as time went on. This building would have probably had a double wide door and then large windows. That was early commercial buildings on the first floor, okay, with residences upstairs. Then, as cast iron technology was developed, you see buildings that have part of the first floor walls cut out and new cast iron put in. That's what happened on this building. Now, the cast iron facade on the first floor, that was made by Gerst Iron, a local iron company that started producing under that label in 1881. So we know that storefront, as it looked, came after 1881, but before our friend Henry Miller lived here.
That's awesome.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
That
so
is.
The building evolved. So I showed Jamie, as I showed yourself, buildings evolving during the mid and late 19th century that were built by immigrants like this building was.
So you dated this building. I know the story. Tell me that.
The area is subdivided for development in 1851, that the streets are platted, not that they're actually constructed or paved, but that they were platted for development. A few years later, an individual buys this property, the Herman family. When he passes away, his widow owns the property, and they own the property for some decade, and it's during their ownership that this building is constructed on the property. We know for sure that it was here in 1870 because this building served as a polling place in the spring of 1870 for a special election that was to raise money to widen streets for the approach to the brand new being built Eads Bridge across the Mississippi.
Wow.
And so we know it was here in 1870, but it predates our building records.
So, and we talked about this, you and I, there is some in the Missouri History Museum Library on Skinker, there is some original blueprints. But a building like this would have been done how? Without any formal drawings of any kind?
This would have been contractor built, and the contractors would have been tradesmen. What makes our city so beautiful, our historic city, is that many of our contractors and even architects started out as bricklayers or carpenters. They worked on projects, they learned how to build them, and went on to then becoming contractors. And then they started designing their own buildings. And this was very typical of buildings constructed in mid-19th century working class areas. So they could have come in here, a group of these laborers, they knew their craft so well. I think other than giving them some measurements, they could have just built this. You know, you give them measurements, you give them some heights, and my God, these guys could do anything.
The original building, mm-hmm. We know the first floor was always retail, correct?
Everything says it was always retail. Everything about it.
And the second level was always, second and third, was always
residential.
Residential boarding space.
Or it could have been the shop owners.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Living upstairs. And then later on is converted to boarding space. These buildings go through so many uses that the use and the neighborhood and the appearance of the building was very different when Henry Miller lived here than from when it was originally constructed.
Okay, but one of the unique aspects of this that kind of surprised us, when we first came in, Dave Roth, business rep, who was also, we had to come in through the windows. There was no way to get in here. Everything was bricked off and it had been abandoned for so long. So my question to you is, we were surprised to find that there was no internal staircase coming up here to the second level. And then when you took me on that architectural tour, you showed me several similar properties that are still that way, where the only access to the second level is through a porch.
In the back.
In the back.
It was off the courtyard. So it was common that the residential units were entered off of outdoor stairs, wooden stairs, and wooden porches that lined the back of the buildings. And the backyards were much more like courtyards than what we currently think of as backyards. And they were real living space. That was how the people lived. That's how the immigrants built these combination stores and flats.
And so we've got this big iconic testament, right, to the birth of the IBEW right here. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling, really, to step across the street and to gaze upon what this has evolved into, thanks to your help and our members across the country who ponied up the money to make this happen. I guess my question is, at the time that Henry stayed here, this building was stacked in amongst others like cordwood.
Absolutely. By the time Henry lives here, this is a very crowded, dense urban neighborhood, packed with immigrants from a variety of countries. Near to a few blocks from here to the south and east was a theater that sat over 1,000 patrons. Yet to the southwest was fine residential area with townhouses. To the east and to the north were packed immigrant areas. This neighborhood, this immediate neighborhood, was like a bridge between very poor tenement areas for new immigrants and townhouses. All kinds of people were coming to this street. It was Franklin Avenue, and they were going to the bakeries here and all. Directly to the east was the community it was made up of Russian Jews and Polish Jews who were escaping the pogroms that even the Polish Jews that were coming over at that point were coming from the part of Poland that was controlled by Russia. And they were suffering from these pogroms. And they became feather pickers and rag pickers. Just a few blocks northeast of here was the neighborhood that grew out of an Irish shanty town that the Irish had settled there, starting with the potato famine, and gradually worked their way up to being middle class, but very crowded area. There was a Sicilian area directly east. There were Germans just west.
So we had all these immigrant groups that had come in, and they had sort of settled in different areas of the city.
Right.
But it was much less blended as we see today, all the multi-ethnic communities that you see today.
Oh, it's so boring today compared to even when I was a kid.
There was a lot of culture. That culture is really...
It was so rich.
Especially if you love history. That culture is just so fascinating.
And every group bringing these different traditions, you think about, we talk about diversity now.
Right.
They lived it. And if you lived in this building, one of the things I was thinking about is summer with the windows open.
Okay, so let me stop you right there. So tell me what would this have been like? Because this is, by the way, we're here today is the 21st, correct? Did I get that right?
I hope.
Today's the 21st. So officially, according to the historic newspapers that I have researched, Today is the opening day of this convention. And we're back here right now. And that's why you see some of the echoes from the audio, because we're in this big open space that would have been Henry's room. So paint for me that picture, what it would have been like on that opening day as these linemen from across the country gathered right in this very room. And I, by the way, full disclosure, I've read your storyboard, and it really does a phenomenal job of taking you back and just putting you right in this space. But I want to hear it from the expert herself.
Well, one thing would have just been the sounds. We would have had the sounds of streetcars on tracks, and that would have made a noise that echoed all over here. They were just electrifying the streetcars. So some would have been electrified and some would have been horse-powered. We would have had the sounds of horses, draft horses, their clip-clop as they pulled the wagons up and down the street right in front of us. And the windows of this building are all, they're right at the sidewalk's edge.
Yep.
So they would have heard all the noises of the street.
So let me ask you that. They would have been wide open. Well, in November, they would have been closed, right? Because it would have been cold.
They may have opened them some because this place, like all mid-19th century homes and dwellings in St. Louis, was heated by cast iron stoves with coal. And those stoves, boy, do they work well. And they really heat up a place. And so undoubtedly, at some point, because it's hard to regulate the heat, it would have gotten too hot and they would have opened windows just to get a little bit of that steam out of here, that heat out. So they would have had the windows open at some point and they would have heard this. They would have heard the voices. They would have heard German bakers and Irish teamsters. And they may have heard some Sicilian because they weren't far away. So you would have heard all these different mix of accents and discussions in a variety of languages.
So our international office curator, Curtis Bateman, who runs the IBW Museum in Washington, D.C., was really complimentary on the work that you did in this setting that we're sitting in today. How did you go about setting up this space where our founding fathers met? In other words, one of the comments that we heard, would the table have been there? Would it have been up front? So it would have been, you believe, it would have been near the windows in the front.
I think they would have had table in this front room with the windows along the street and the beds in the back room.
Okay.
Because it just at nighttime, it would have been quieter for them. The other thing is, houses were built in St. Louis up through working class houses, up through World War I, that you walked through the bedroom to get to the kitchen and other rooms. That was not uncommon. The other thing is that room would have been closer to the outhouse. You wanted the bedroom closer to the outhouse.
Well, that makes perfect sense. So there you go.
But it doesn't mean that at times they may have had a whole lot of men living here, just depending on what kinds of projects were going on in St. Louis. At times this could have housed as many as, say, 8 men. And in that case, they may have had beds in both rooms.
I see.
It would have fluctuated and just changed in a boarding house.
So boarding house life. What would boarding house life have been like in Henry's day? So we know the building was already over 20 years old when Henry stayed here.
Mm-hmm.
We know it was John Greb that was the saloon owner downstairs.
Right.
So Henry would have come here, right? And the saloon?
He would have had his meals here. That's what boarding house life meant. You got room and food. And so they probably got what we called plate lunches from the saloon. They probably cooked and served food there also, and these gentlemen got their dinners there. When it was crowded, it would have been almost like a barracks living here. But at other times, he might have had a full 2 rooms for maybe a month to himself. The floors would have been, well, they were pine, they were rough, and they would have been unfinished and raw, and they would be scrubbed. They covered the floors with either linoleum rugs. Rugs were very expensive and hard to clean. And so whoever was managing the boarding house would not have wanted rugs here. Very hard work to clean rugs. So they would have had linoleum rugs, squares of linoleum, or oilcloths. I couldn't find anywhere that made what were called linoleum rugs anymore. I couldn't find anywhere that made linoleum. But we found someone in the Northwest who made oilcloths for the floors. These are similar to a linoleum rug, but they start with a flax sheet, and I found directions for how to make them in ladies' magazines from that period, and it started out with take the flax and tack it to the side of the barn, and then paint it and put coats of shellac and paint on it. And each step you let set for several days to a week. So they took a long time to make, and then with the last layer of paint, you painted designs on them that often imitated wealthy people's rugs, and then you covered them with a final coat of shellac.
And that's what we have here.
That's what we have both around the table, and they would have been easy to clean. They would have also kept the drafts out, because now you've got like a subflooring here, but these floors, you've got the original flooring here. There would have been gaps, splinters. They were rough floors. This, again, was a building from mid-century before we had as much fine milling equipment that we could have the really smooth, beautiful floors with all the finishes on them. So he would have, I'm sure he wanted to wear heavy socks and shoes at all times in this building and on this floor. He would have gone out those back steps. In summertime, he may even have slept on the back porch.
For a cooler location.
Yes. And then up through, I found that in the 1930s, there still was not a toilet in either of these upstairs units. No toilets up here. There was some variation of an outhouse. Early on, the outhouses were just built over a hole or a pit they dug. Then, in some cases, they started to build the outhouses right over the new sewer lines. Now, I don't know where the sewer line was here. And then they also built outhouses. They were smart. I mean, how they used nature to take care of things was remarkable. They had outhouses over vaults that drained into the sewers, but they had shed roofs on the outhouses. When it rained, the water went from the shed roof into the gutter to the downspout, and the downspout sent the water to wash out the vaults.
Wow.
I never, when I would, this opportunity gave me a chance to learn more about how working class people lived. Like that, I had never known until I started studying plumbing to understand what life was like for Henry Miller. And I found out about their inventive outhouses.
Wow. That's pretty fascinating.
And I gave something here. Did you know that? I found a historic chamber pot from the neighborhood.
I do remember hearing.
Yes, I'm very proud of this. My contribution is it truly is a chamber pot from the era and actually from the neighborhood. It was in a house in this area for five generations. So that's my big contribution.
Well, we appreciate it. That's not your only contribution. Just for the record, you've made some significant contributions here. I'm sitting here looking around at all of them now, including your storyboards, which do such a great job. I know we've brought several members from across the country come here, and the reps for Local One drop everything they're doing, run down here, and they'll give a tour.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure that they wish they could spend more time here. I know that when I give a tour here, I say, okay, I start talking, and then I watch their eyes, and if they start to glaze over, then I usually stop.
But it takes a long time.
But you and I, we could talk about this for a long
forever.
Time. But members really, really have been moved by this space. We take pictures mm-hmm. adjacent to the Henry Miller statue down in the elevator lobby. We take pictures outside. We take pictures in this space, in the room that we were founded in. And you have brought, what, three large groups?
Five.
Five.
Three classes. I teach St. Louis history to adults, and I've had three classes that we came here that we could then learn about Union history in this city, about ethnic history, and just what life was like for our ancestors. And then tour groups, too. And they're all, the exciting thing is when each tour group I brought, when I brought busloads, there was always somebody who was either married to an IBEW member or even had been an IBEW member. They were from the side or whatever, not members of the local here, and they didn't know this place existed. So we have work to do, John.
Well, the linemen in particular, our founder was a lineman, and they're very proud of this building. In the newspapers I've read of the day, Henry worked for the Municipal Light and Power Company, and for a time they go on strike to try to get $2.50 a day. What would, if he lives here in 1891, his income level, say he's around $2 a day, how would that fare? Do we have a comparison for that? Would he have been probably doing better off than most of the people that stayed in this building, you think?
Yes. Yeah.
That would have afforded him the ability to do some of what he was able to do.
I think so. It's hard to compare a single man with a family man at that time. Many cases, the families pooled their resources. And they learned by necessity to pool their resources, and so they could live fairly well. But, you know, you look at that $2.50 a day compared to the rag pickers and the feather pickers, he was doing
pretty well.
Pretty well, comparatively.
In the Chinese laundry that we know was there,
yes.
adjacent on the first level, the 2726 side of the building, adjacent to John Greb's Saloon, would he have utilized those laundry?
They weren't there when he was here.
Oh, they weren't?
No. The Chinese laundry moves in later.
Okay.
And that is their Irish laundries and then Chinese laundries. The laundries are spread throughout the city so that they are close to their customers, and that is brutal work. It was probably the person who managed this boarding house who did the laundry, and that would have been tough, tough work.
And
laundry was brutal work.
And I do see several advertisements in the city directories of the day where this address was looking for someone to do laundry.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Because they had a business and they had a boarding house. And at times, I have found other boarding houses this size that at times they had as many as 8 men boarding in the rooms, which at that point it would have been very barracks-like. So if you had the laundry for 8 working men and you're doing it on a scrub board, and you're boiling the buckets of water and hauling the buckets of water and draining those tubs, that was very, very hard work. And for one person to do that much laundry, for the lady managing this place, perhaps the wife of John Greb, managing the boarding house, it would have been could get overwhelming.
So you think a saloon owner was married, huh?
Often they were. Often. You know,
Charlie, what kind of lady must she have been?
Been a hardworking woman who did a lot of dishes, washed a lot of steins, and swept a lot of floors.
A lot of tobacco chewing going on, apparently.
Can you imagine? Oof. Oh, my goodness. And the smoke. And, you know, that brings up one thing that has not been recreated here, and that is the dirt. Everything in this place is clean.
Pristine, yes.
Yes. And the coal-fueled cast iron stoves would have created dust. The dust would have created a thin film on the walls, and all the smoking and all these corncob pipes, all that smoke would have been in these rooms. And so, but we don't know how to recreate dirt at this point. The same dirt, at least. We can't do historic dirt yet.
You know so much about St. Louis history, but I'm going to ask you a John Carhoff question. All right. Now, this is just me. This is just somebody who doesn't have your acumen when it comes to the history of our city. What would the wall coverings have been in Henry's time? Let me ask you that question first.
Okay. There may have been a chair rail right at the height of the top of a chair. And then above the chair rail, a different kind of wall covering than below.
Would it have been paper or would have been
they
stenciled?
They may have done paper. They could have done stenciled. If stenciled, it would have been a very simple design, and probably it was left over from earlier, before when owner residents were in here, when it was more of a family dwelling rather than a boarding house. So the wall coverings were probably whatever was here 10 or 15 years before.
Okay, so my question, the reason I asked that question.
Okay.
Is we've got this, and maybe you can help with this too, but we've got this iconic photograph of these 10 men.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
We don't know when it was taken, but when we first started to do the renovation, you know, every time they peeled off another layer of these wall coverings, they would call me, hey, John, we found something.
Yeah.
Come take a look. I'm sort of kidding with this, but I would be here with the tweezers.
You know? Right.
And I would have this original photograph, and I would be comparing it to of the design on the wall of the time. And what we found is that so much of the original coverings were gone and had decayed to the point where there was still an outline there. It was almost like it had been bleached out, even though the original paint had decayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we never did find anything that directly matched it. But if a photograph of the day, would they have established a backdrop instead of...
Often... The photographs would have been done in studios.
Okay.
The studios had a backdrop.
Okay.
Okay. This building, mid-19th century, shows the style of building of German craftsmen. They would have had plaster walls, and likely the Germans often had kind of a bluish paint that was almost chalky that was on the walls. Later, as wallpaper became more common and more affordable, they would have had wallpaper with a print on it. But when this was a rooming house, they would not have spent money to have the latest wallpapers up there.
Okay, so they would
have gone to a studio. They would
have,
for that photo, for a group of people posing, they had to be in a studio.
Okay.
And they would have curtains with rooms painted on them, and then maybe one table out there, and that's what the people would pose in front of.
And that makes
sense.
That would
not have been here.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, and that gives you an idea of how it's hard to step out of your current bubble. Certainly a photographer would not have come to this boarding house to take a photo. So they would have said, let's commemorate this occasion. Let's go down to so-and-so's studio and have a photograph taken.
And there were a lot of photographers in this area, because it was German, and the Germans did the photography, or there were Germans nearby, and they set up studios. So when you have communities with Germans, you have photographic studios available.
So one of the things, so, but we still searched. It was exciting. Sure. Every time they found something that they thought remotely resembled the backdrop of that original photo, we would run out here and take out a magnifying glass.
And hope that that was it. But, you're right.
That makes perfect sense.
I just to set up lighting, the equipment and all of it, it would have been very challenging to do that here.
And the resources they had financially would not have made that a possibility.
No,
would have been a waste of their resources when they had so many other things. And I've thought about that too, the perspective. You know, I think about the day-to-day business of the IBW comes first right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, 100 years from now, you know, John Karhoff is going to want to know where we took this photo. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
you know what I mean? That's really not what's that that's
not the priority of the day. You've got to think about what their priorities were. And I'm impressed that they thought to do the photo.
Yeah, me too.
They felt they were doing something really important. And you can see just how dignified their pose is and all. It was important.
Unbelievable, the formality. If you look at one of the prized possessions that we have here was just a recreation of the original convention, our inaugural convention minutes that happened in this room that were reprinted in 1991 for our 100th anniversary.
Yeah.
And they were given as a keepsake. And we have those sitting on this table so that members can see the incredible penmanship of T.J. Fennell, Thomas J. Fennell. When you look at that penmanship of a lineman, you know, isn't that, that's mind-boggling to me that someone could script those original convention minutes and make it just that absolutely beautiful. So the formality of it is what I'm getting at. The formality of the fact that these men sat here in this boarding house room, right, with literally nothing. I mean, nothing. Poor, and had this formal Robert's Rules of Order style convention and documented it so thoroughly and so accurately and so much formality. It just, it reiterates how serious they were and how committed they were to the formation of our organization.
And it fills you with admiration because they, I'm sure they complained about things, but the thing is they weren't just complaining. They were putting such effort into changing the world. They prove you can change the world. They did it and change it for generations. And I'm just in awe. I am in awe. And that's why I think this is so important.
And one of the things that I tried to find when I went to the Missouri History Museum Library is an old photograph of this region to try to see what this building may have looked like at the time. And you actually gave me some insight on where to go because of a photo that you had found of a retailer pretty close to this address location.
Zerensky.
That now owns the Galleria Mall, the family does. Any additional insights on the building itself and its history and the evolutions of the building that you would want to share?
And there are no building permits for this building for the beginning, for the original construction. That is because this appears to predate our building permit system. I looked up 5,000 to 10,000 building permits, and the earliest I found are 1876, 77. This building was already here.
Gotcha.
The atlases were a great help, but more similar buildings that you can trace the story of. Here we know the Hermann family built this, and it's a German name, and it has a German style to it. And we know it was built during their ownership. And I'm just going to keep looking.
Is there any element that you wanted to save architecturally when you were first brought in as a consultant on the project?
You did it all. There is one thing you can't do simply because you made this work. You saved the building that was in desperate shape. So there's something we just have to explain to people when we show them in the back, where there are elevators and new systems and restrooms. that's where there would have been a gallery-style porch. And we can just explain that to people as we show them, and that they did use these porches in our hot St. Louis summers, and that they would have sat there having a stein of beer and some sausage and some kraut on those porches on a summer evening.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because the newspapers of the day during our first convention, they talk about the final day's banquet was held at Ulrich's Cave. And Ulrich's Cave is literally within walking distance of here. Yeah. It's right around the corner. That was a German beer garden.
Yes.
Originally, the Ulrich brothers in the 1860s bought a section of property from Dr. Beaumont, who owned all this property around here. There were several natural underground caves, and they discovered that because of the temperature before artificial refrigeration, they could store their Bock beer that they brewed in these underground caves. And about the 1870s, they built an underground storage facility that the newspapers reported cost $100,000. Now, eventually they would sell it to the McNair brothers, who would build this German beer garden over the top of it. And it was that Ulrich's Cave, the newspapers report, as being our final banquet of the convention.
How wonderful.
That would have been entertainment. I've heard conflicting opinions on this, on whether or not they believe that our founding fathers would have had the financial resources to go have a banquet at Ulrich's Cave. What's your opinion on that?
Well, what they describe as a banquet probably was not as elaborate as we define a banquet. Going out and all of them having a big dinner together, it was a banquet.
Very plausible.
But it just was not, it didn't have to be lavish or expensive. They just enjoyed a meal together, and that was the term for it.
And they would have just walked right down there probably.
They would have walked down there, absolutely, and enjoyed the coolness of the cave. And what a wonderful image. What a wonderful image of their sharing camaraderie on their last night together. And they all would have been beer drinkers. Everybody drank beer.
There would have been beer, you believe? Or?
Well, there would have been a lot of beer here, but you're right. There would have been a lot of whiskey. And the Irish neighborhood was nearby. And my Irish family, they drank whiskey. The German side drank beer. And everybody drank wine. They all drank wine. So we had a lot of wine production here also. They also drank a lot of soda at that time. And in fact, when you were digging up the backyard, you found some soda bottles that had embossed in the glass, a company that was just a few blocks from here. There was a soda factory. And I'm not sure why they drank so much soda. Perhaps at that time, the soda water was treated so that it was actually healthier or safer than some city water. But soda water was very common in the late 19th century. Isn't that surprising? When it was something I didn't expect to stumble into. And it may have been a soda that they sold downstairs at John Greb's saloon.
What would that saloon atmosphere have been like? Probably not a lot of tables, right? It was pretty narrow.
There would have likely been an upright piano. This was St. Louis. And it was probably a piano manufactured in St. Louis. And they probably had music that was, the sheet music was probably published in St. Louis. We were a major music producer.
Scott Joplin House, less than, 100 yards or so from here?
That's right.
And he was a contemporary of Henry Miller.
That's right. Isn't that an amazing piece of history? There was an African American community very nearby. And so they were part of the environment. You would have had a lot of people stopping in here at the end of the day and really enjoying the saloon. Because think how small the living quarters were for working families. Again, we're in two rooms here that at times, I'm sure, housed up to eight people. Family men, you would have a family packed into two or three rooms. I always believed that men went on to the saloon and religious retreats for the same reason. Sooner or later, they just had to get away from all the children and the mother-in-law living in the house and maybe sister-in-laws. Things were very crowded. This city had 450,000 people when Henry Miller lived here. And the city part that was actually developed as housing was a fraction of what it is now. Almost everyone lived not just east of Grand, but east of Jefferson. The population was very crowded. You see it spread out a little bit more after he is here because of the electrification of streetcars. Before that, you had to be able to walk to the factories. So men would have been walking home from work, and they would have stopped in downstairs for a beer or a whiskey or whatever, or gone home and had dinner and come back for a little peace and quiet, or when, you know, children had to do homework, because they did. They had lots of homework. And we had wonderful school systems. Everything was close. Everything was close in their lives.
So your latest book features the Henry Miller Museum. And I went down, full disclosure, it's been a while now. That's been out for a while. You advertised that it was available for sale. I think I might have saw it on your Facebook page.
Yeah, it came out this spring.
I went down immediately, got in my car, drove down to the History Museum because I know they carry your books down there. By the way, I have a hardback copy of Downtown St. Louis, which Nene autographed for me, and she gave me as a gift. It's one of my treasured items. Well, I love the old photographs.
You've got to hold on to that because we're bringing out a new edition, but it won't be hardcover, and it won't have all the great number of images that book had. So you've got to hold on to that.
That is an awesome book, and
such a
generous gift. I appreciate it, and it's sitting right adjacent to where I sit in my living room. It's still sitting there. You know, every time I see a book like that, I go through those and I look at those old photographs and I think, oh, come on, Franklin Avenue. Come on, Franklin Avenue.
The frustration with finding images of this immediate area was just overwhelming. And we may someday run across an image of this building. And I'm still hoping to stumble into more clues that make it, when it was built, more specific. And I think we will run into things. Between you and me, eventually, we will be able to document more and more of this building. When you opened it, I didn't know it was a polling place in 1870. Now we know that. You know, there'll be more things. And we will pin things down. And hopefully we'll find a photo. But I know I'm looking for that photo of this block. And just like you, we'll find it eventually.
The Compton and Dry map, the hand-drawn map that came out in 1876, does show this structure here.
Yeah, it shows the back side of it. And that is a very valuable resource. And there again, you compare the backside images to other buildings that are still standing in other parts of town to go look at them and get comparisons of buildings. But this building fit right in with the theme of my latest book, This Used to Be St. Louis, which is built on the concept that this city's history is so rich and lush and layered. And everything you look at today, it's this wonderful thing now, but you find out that 50 or 100 years ago, it was something totally different that was wonderful. Or 150 years ago, it had a whole different story. So with each of these places and sites in this city, and that I got to feature in the book, the most challenging thing was to choose which part of the stories to even tell. You can, like you have found with this building is such a remarkable history, and we're still digging it up. And that's just one building. There's just one building. But this building, again, is now it is half museum, half shrine. You teach and you maintain quality. Where would we be without that influence in any of our cities or small towns if we didn't have the influence of unions maintaining a quality level and an education level for their members that they... I'm just horrified at the thought. Yeah. You know, and you all you have to consider are things like fire insurance. Every American, whether or not you're in a union of any kind, you have a safer home, a better environment, and your insurance is lower because of unions.
That's true. It is a wonderful space. We really appreciate your contribution. You can find Nene at neneharris.com.
Yes.
You're on Facebook, facebook.com/Nene Harris. Wonderful books on the history of St. Louis, and we appreciate everything you've done to promote it to all your tour groups.
It has been my honor.
And I've learned a great deal from you on the history of our city, and it's always fun to talk to you. And I agree with the young lady on your website when she said, every time I go on a walk and talk with Nene, I learn something new. And so thanks again for agreeing to sit down with us. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, IBW. In the room where it all began with Nene Harris.